Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
And Brian Brushwood.
Oh my God, it's so good to be back in studio. You guys, I assume you soared like eagles in my absence.
Yes. Like eagle lander, like in the moon missions.
like eagle scouts. We did our best.
Like eagle eye cherry, you guys rocked the crowds.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I think it's time for a tonal shift in our show. I think we've talked about a lot of sensational stories and things like that, but I think there's a lot of really important stuff going on in this world. And I think it's kind of our responsibility to maybe cover some of these other sort of things, not be so sensational, but maybe try to give people sort of a solid background in science and educational policy, et cetera. So I know I should have talked about this before the show, but I just thought it'd be appropriate just to sort of say, let's just do this now. Let's not kind of be the flippant sort of show we are before. Okay.
Yeah. No. Turning over a new leaf where we are. Look, we were at the top of the science charts because of all our science, not for being fun or interesting. Let's knock that nonsense off.
Yeah. Let's make it like a paper, we're just going to read science papers from here on out. Only the information.
Welcome to Civilized Things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to start off with? Is Bigfoot a carnivore, or do they find the gates of hell in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, boy. I want to hear about the gates of hell in Saudi Arabia. Because
Brian. Wait, Justin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Justin, do you want to weigh in on that? I'm sorry.
No. I do believe they're due to the fact that this is a very important premise that the gates of hell in Saudi Arabia are the most prescient thing to do talk about.
Hold on one second, sir. Heretofore, forthwith, with your supposed innuendo and scientific malfeasance, I imagine forthwith you'll comply.
No, if indeed, if I might, with all due respect, rebut your statement, there is a lot of supporting documentary evidence that you will see in my bibliography that the Saudi Arabia gates of hell are the way that we need to proceed on this path cautiously. Mm. Cautiously.
I recommend reckless abandon, but let us listen to the facts next.
It's kind of like Inherit the Wind meets the Churchill movie.
Some people, researchers, I guess we'll call them, they got some
footage, some aerial photos, not aerial, they had to get satellite photos of Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, they're not really into letting you do flyovers, et cetera, but there had been some features on the ground that were of a particular interest, particularly because they're really near this really intense lava field. And you look at this, think you're looking at the surface of Mars. And they've noticed these rectangular formations of rocks that they're trying to date. And some estimates maybe put these things as being 8,000, 9,000 years old. And that environment would have been radically different, radically different. I understand that 9,000 years ago, we were still kind of just getting out of the grips of the Ice Age, which we're still in. We're interglacial, just a show note. And you would have had the water levels would have been much lower. Climates would have been very different. This region could have been much, much wetter and not just this barren sort of wasteland that it appears to be. So if you look at some of the images from this, we'll see what else we can find from there. You'll see some close-up images of these things that are several hundred feet long. And they are clearly, you know, human-made. Well, intelligent-made. I don't want to make any assumptions here. And they form these sort of rectangular structures that are maybe just a couple feet high, which – to researchers, they say, we don't think they could have been used as animal pens. But the problem we have is whenever you look at something, you don't know if that's the structure or if that's the foundation for a structure. And you have to do a lot more, digging, et cetera, to find out, because there could have been, maybe there were fence posts in there. Maybe there were wooden, because, again, there could have been a lot of materials there to build from that we don't see there now. So it could have been a corral, or it could just be some creepy, weird, symbolic thing edged into the ground.
Help me get a sense of scale on this. Like, if we're boots on the ground, are we talking yards or miles? How big is this?
So if you're looking, some of them were like several hundred feet long, and I think there's some images there of some people standing near. Like, you can see part of where they're standing in, like, a structure there.
Well, and to there. Look at this picture, it looks like they're standing next to something maybe 6, 10, 12 inches tall, tops. Like, so mm-hmm. I see what you're saying with it doesn't make sense as animal pens or even as a demarcation of property boundaries.
Yeah, and again, as they are, and that's the thing we always have to keep in mind is that we're looking at what's left over. And there's often times where we found stuff where we're like, oh, we think this was just some sort of weird ceremonial thing. And then somebody finds the remnants of fence posts or, you know, and they're like, oh, maybe there was a roof over this and it did something else. So let me give you some of that. There's something like 400 of the gates in the area. And there's been some are anywhere from 40 feet long to nearly 1,700 feet long. They're pretty crude. They don't look like they were using, you know, very, you know, I think that, you know, 5,000-6,000 years later in some regions we had better building technique for doing straighter lines and stuff. These appear to be built by people who maybe don't have, I'm going to say, a lot of experience building things, you know, like a lot of, you know, inherited knowledge.
Yeah, so. Because they're demons.
Well,
demons don't kind of protractors.
What is this area like nowadays? We saw a bunch of volcanic activity, like volcanoes and stuff around. Like, is it a livable environment, or is it too hot for humans to inhabit?
I actually wrote about this region in one of my books years ago, and it's a very, parts of it are just very inhospitable because you've got a lot of volcanic rock. It's very, very hot, and it's, you know, not conducive to necessarily growing things, et cetera, not much soil, you know, which is already kind of a problem in Saudi Arabia to begin with. So, but again, we're talking about today, 9,000 years ago. This could have been, it could have been marsh. It could have been, that could have been, because one of the things you had 9,000 years ago, you had rising levels of water. And some of these structures, though, look like they're on like the surface of like carved into or built into like a volcano caldera, which could mean, you know, looks like the dome. So, I mean, it's kind of curious, you know, like which came first. You know, they talk about how where they are, they're in these very unwelcome places. But again, these were, you know, built when, you know, this environment was very different. So it could have been, you know, could have been marsh, you know, could have been, there could have been just a little low level flooding and maybe this was enough to preserve it there. Maybe they built, you know, mud mounds around there. Who knows? There could have been mud. One of the things we found out too is, let me just keep going for 1 second, is, you know, we've had these ruins like Mohenjo-Daro, they call it the Mound of the Dead because they found the city covered in dirt, covered in, like, why were they covered? And we've had a number of these cities, like, why did they cover these cities in dirt? Well, maybe it was because back then the environment was different and the rivers overflooded and they were flooded with silt.
Sure.
And that seems to be what we found now. That's what we go, oh no, it wasn't an intentional thing. That's why they left. So.
Yeah. So mistaking cause and effect.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, that's the biggest bummer. There's a book written by Pierce Anthony that I forgot the name of. It was in the late 60s. And one of the things they do is they fold space and time so that people get super far away from Earth, but then they do something extraordinary. They turn a telescope at Earth, and because they've gotten so far away, they're able to look back and watch the ancient Phoenicians walking around. I love that as a theatrical conceit in a book, but more importantly, I realize that we'll never be able to do that. We'll never be able to truly look into our past. The best we can hope for is a level of forensic science that allows us to make a guess and tell a story that's so good. Oh, it is. It's Macroscope. That's Bryce has already found it. Yeah, Macroscope is the book. It's such a bummer to me that we can never truly look back and know for absolute certainty how our story started.
You know, yeah, information loss sucks. There, I was playing with an idea that I wanted to use for a science fiction story, and I thought it'd be kind of a neat sort of notion. The idea was quantum compression. And the idea was that, like, let's say and it's, this is sci-fi. This is not like, hey guys, here's my brilliant idea. But I thought this would make a cool sci-fi theory, which is the idea. Like, let's say you want to have a really neat form. You wanted to like figure out like, I need to know what the, a 1934 Volkswagen looked like, a Luger and all this sort of stuff. So what I'll do is I'll start off with, you know, the ingredients of the Big Bang as a starting point, and then figure out what will give me a picture of Hitler at the podium, you know, doing, you know, speaking to people. How many, let it create a bunch of different universes until it arrives at one where you get that image.
Oh, so you are creating, you are growing the history that you assume is closest to our own.
Just create a billion different, you know, trillions of different, you know, histories of the universe until I get one that this pops up. And that way, all I need is that photo of Hitler and to say, and what universe just come up like, okay, now tell me what the design is for a Luger, all these other things, et cetera.
And then be like, all right, cool. Well, we're done. So bye.
Yeah, we got to collapse that universe.
Universe is.
So, but to your point, Brian, what I brought that up was the idea that a thing that has been sort of a fascination of mine is how much can we use computation to try to reconstruct? How much can we, you know, say, okay, we know this is here and this is here, and we won't have a definitive answer, but we could say, knowing now that like, oh, you know, if we have a better view of the hydrological cycle of that region, knowing how other things have grown and developed, could you give us a better picture? Could you give us these, there's this computational archaeology, predictive archaeology, and I think we can get better, much, much better pictures of the past, but not, we will never know the exact precise past, to your point. But I think that I'm encouraged.
I guess the weird part is I don't even need to know that this is the definitive actual way it went. I just need a vivid enough explanation and depiction of it that I can scratch that mental itch and say, if not this, something like this. Now I understand where we came from and what it looked like and so on. I guess I'm looking for fine storytellers to make me feel better about how we got here.
Well, but imagine if we had a massive database of historical information. It was ranked by what we think is very accurate, things that maybe were accurate or not. A lot of data about, like, even trying to find like coastline data from 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 years ago is hard, but we did that. Better data about what plants were there and a lot of stuff, and then put this into the most advanced version of Sims you could think of.
Right.
And, you know, then we could all hop into our VR and go walk through a Roman village because we said we know this much about Roman villages. We're going to make inferences that, you know, we found just the outline of a fence in the northern region of France. But we think if there was a Roman village here, it would look like this. It would probably mean there are people that lived here near there like this, et cetera. It could fill in a lot of data and create a very realistic experience. And then we could test things and say, can we find proof that there was a farm here? Can we find evidence that, you know, there was a foundry here or other things? And you might find that, and then that sort of adds, sort of increases the confidence of that estimation.
Yeah, I wonder if, I don't know, this is nothing new, but, you know, that scene from Jurassic Park where they thumped the ground and they're able to see the reverberations of a raptor skeleton or whatever. It just seems like so much of our history is so improbably buried in extraordinary places that would be difficult to excavate. What are we looking at? 20, 30, 50, 100 years before we have devices that are able to, you know, just using have precise enough to get the echoes of everything and draw pictures of lost civilizations?
We're actually, there's some things that are really exciting as far as doing different kinds of different forms of radar, different forms of like even think of like how a CAT scan works or an MRI. The idea that we might be able to build something that's a field version of that, that just gives off this pulse and everything responds. It's a matter of fidelity. And there's a lot of really cool stuff kind of rumored at government tech and things you could do too. Let's say we just have a bunch of little nano ants that we just say, hey guys, just crawl into the ground and make a grid. You know,
well, or what if, and this is the nutty part to me, is why bother with nano ants, synthetic replacements for ants? Why not genetically engineer ants that just have a compulsion to dig in these directions and report back data somehow?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I think that if there's a effort or whatever to do that, and I guess this is a great, talking about this is a good segue into, want to jump into the Hyperloop thing?
Yeah. What states announced a thingamajig?
So just a quick background. Like, when we talked about Hyperloop and some of this stuff, I think we're all kind of like, yeah, that's a great idea, but the world we live in, we're not going to get these nice things, you know?
And specifically there, what we're talking about is land acquisition, state and federal funding, referendums that need to be passed for it, that there's a lot of the history of cross state lines or even in state lines, mass transit that is hostile to innovation and oftentimes, again, we're not able to get nice things.
So here's a headline from TechCrunch. Daryl Etherington writes, Elon Musk week is going pretty great thus far between meeting the creators of Rick and Morty and now gaining permission to dig even more tunnels. Besides one, he already got the okay to begin digging closer to home in Hawthorne. For those of you who don't remember, he's got permission to dig a tunnel, part of a tunnel, a test tunnel. Most of the steps of the permission, I think there's probably still some things to go, to start digging in, you know, right out near the SpaceX factory. And now his company, The Boring Company, which you can buy hats for, by the way, if you go into the Boring Company website, you can get your own boring hat. I think mine arrives in a couple days. The new tunnel will be a 10.3-mile route that undercuts a state-owned operation of the Baltimore-Washington Parkway in Maryland and could eventually become the anchor point for a network that would span Washington, New York, with stops in between in urban centers in Baltimore and Philadelphia, according to the LA Times. This is where it comes from. So they've got permission, and this is kind of the way that it was done, which is really very interesting. Maryland Transportation Secretary Pete Ron told the LA Times the tunnel really wasn't any different from the various utility access points. So that's the way that they're able to give him permission to do this. They're saying, hey, this is kind of like a utility system, like utility digging tunnels for fiber optics, et cetera. And there are more steps to go through. But they said, like, well, they haven't got permission from everybody. But, quotes are from this thing is real. It's really exciting to see. Maryland Transportation Secretary Pete Ron said. The word transformation will be overused, but this is technology that leapfrogs any technologies out here today, and it's going to be here. The cities along the route hadn't necessarily granted permission, but Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh said that she was excited to hear more, and the enthusiasm is pretty much, there.
Let me ask you a question then, Negative Nelly. Does this make you more or less excited
about season 5 of The Wire?
This is a thing.
It'll be about the Hyperloop in Baltimore, sure. Maryland.
So here's my question. The Hyperloop has always seemed to me, we're all Elon Musk fanboys here. The Hyperloop seems like a fantastic solution to a problem that is not so universal, is what I perceive. Is this a fantastic logistical way to move stuff? Are they moving Amazon Prime boxes? Are they moving human bodies? Like what is the pressing problem that we perceive this is going to solve?
Well, Brian, if I lived in the transportation paradise of Austin.
Oh, okay. we got some traffic here.
From the sound of your voice there, sir, I don't know. And again, like, we work at home.
That's true. All of this boils down to whether or not it makes economic sense, right? Like,
yep.
all that boils down to is, like, how much, what's the ticket price? How bad is the problem for hundreds of thousands of people every day going to and fro?
How many transportation solutions have been foisted upon us that made absolutely no economic sense, but there was plenty of opportunity for ridiculous funding?
Let's put it like this. If there were no BART, would living in Oakland make sense for my wife, for example, who works in San Francisco? If she had to drive in or she had to find a carpool all the time, would it make as much sense for us to live where we live, which is across a bay? Maybe a little less. And therefore, like, if you can now spread out, I can take a job in this place and live in this other place. I think there is a tangible benefit to it, but you need to be realistic and have it like Brian said, make actual sense and not just kind of do it to do it, which is what we've seen with light rails.
You know, in Maryland, and that's that area there, I mean, that's a great example where millions of people have to go through there every day, and there's just not enough transportation options for there. And that's a problem, and it's an impediment. There's only so many places they can put highways. There's only so much traffic or people they can move over. And they have, you know, they have the Acela corridor, you know, is very active. They use it. This is a thing that's fully, you know, used very heavily. And I think that in certain locations in the early, I mean, in, when we, and we always have to qualify by talking about timeframes, 50 years from now, you know, when money's not a problem, our concept of money, you know, it'd be easier to say, yeah, you could build this here or there. But when these things do cost billions of dollars, it's, yeah, it's a, pardon my, as I hit the microphone, it's a very rational, you know, like, is it really worth it? But I think in some areas, maybe. I don't know. I think there's so many technical things that have to be solved, but I'm encouraged by the enthusiasm.
Well, and
it's surprising me.
So far, out of all the different arguments, when you were talking about between, you know, I forget what the two Middle Eastern cities were to build a Hyperloop in between them, when essentially it's like an alien, you know, the surface of Venus between the two, then, you know, I could totally, totally see that. But man, just carving a trench through urban developed areas, I'm hopeful. We'll see.
Well, that's the whole idea of the Boring Company, was that he was like, when he realized how many problems there were going to be in trying to get surface permission to do this and how that is, and then he looked into like, okay, what about digging tunnels? And that was his, okay, well, we need to have next generation tunneling tech that won't, you don't, you know, like we've talked about before, like the way we used to dig tunnels was you dug a trench and then you covered it over, and that was easy. Now, because you have millions of dollars of property development, streets, things like that, you can't, you know, interfere with. And many, many municipalities and places, you don't do that anymore. You got to dig straight under there, and that's ridiculously expensive.
How deep do you think they have to go to not disturb anyone? Like is there the equivalent of international waters if you go deep enough?
So just put a casino down there, like, you know, you're just serving alcohol to minors, like.
So one of the things that he talked about, and I think that, you know, Musk has pointed out, like, the depth at which these things go. I think it's something like, it, I want to say 20 feet or 30 feet or something to that effect. He says you will not notice anything on the surface at all, that the Israelis, you know, have been trying to spend a considerable amount of money to find terrorist tunnels and things like that, because you get the amount of the energy gets just absorbed by everything around you. And so you're not going to notice anything on the surface. It's background noise. And that was sort of his promise, was like, if you feel our tunnel digging, if you hear us digging underneath you, our office is right in front of SpaceX, right? That's the site. Show up and tell us, you know. He's very, very confident that nobody will realize what's going through there. You know, of course, we love Elon,
Is. If you just have, if you crack the code and you just make a mole tunneling gizmo that simultaneously carves and reinforces and basically just, you know, takes dirt and leaves behind a safe, secure tunnel.
Yeah, they have an FAQ here at boringcompany.com.
Yeah.
Is there disruptive surface vibration or noise during tunneling? No. Once a TBM, tunneling boring machine, is below a certain depth, approximately 2 tunnel diameters or 28 feet in this case, the tunneling process is almost impossible to detect, especially in soft soil. So they've got a bunch of Q&As there, and they talk about their plans for like moving things. They don't get into the Hyperloop here. This is just pretty much talking about just digging the tunnels to make it easier to move vehicles back and forth on the platforms, et cetera.
That's crazy.
It's very, you know, it's very interesting. People are, you know, approaching it. But the goal they explain is that they talk about, you know, about Gary the Snail?
No.
Wait,
you're talking about SpongeBob's pet?
Elon Musk's kids have a pet snail named Gary, named for, and he lives in a pineapple, right?
Yeah.
And they explain how traditional, you know, tunneling machines are far, far slower. A snail is 14 times faster than a traditional tunnel boring machine.
Oh,
that
wow.
That snail goes 14 times faster.
So their goal is to
faster.
Beat Gary?
Is their goal is
Gary.
To beat Gary.
The goal is to beat Gary.
That's great. That's amazing.
Yeah. So... the race is on.
So I guess the idea here is then that, number one, it is more exciting for the possibility that this exists because going underground requires less permission and seemingly, based on these moves, are more attractive to local governments. And now the question is, not the question, but the possibility that this will exist is more likely?
Yeah, I think we'll see. And just to address a couple things in the comments. Somebody says, if you own the land, you own it all the way down. It depends upon where you live. And this varies state by state, county by county, city by city. That's not the case, you know, in many, many situations.
Well, and we already have established that it's not the case for the air above you. I mean, commercial airlines don't need your permission to fly over, quote unquote, your airspace. I would imagine that a similar set of laws would be enacted for the area below you.
Yeah, mineral rights, et cetera. You know, like when they dug the latest extension of the L.A. subway, you know, you did not have to clear for parts of that that went under, if it went well enough underneath there. So it's highly variable. Question was, why are we more skeptical of this than the big Falcon rocket?
Mainly because like tunneling is, it's a fairly known, let me put it this way. This is probably 100% inaccurate, but my gut says, because we've seen so many fraud, busts in public transportation,
monorail, The Simpsons.
Yeah, exactly, right? We have a long and storied history of public-funded projects that involve underground tunneling and public transportation that have been garbage and have screwed over the taxpayer. This is not a theoretical way to get boondoggled and hornswoggled. We have a long and storied history, so it smells like the Hialeah of public transportation. And that's not, you know, it's not Hialeah's fault, but that's what it smells like.
So... I think that the problem comes into it. To build a big Falcon rocket, you need a guy with a bunch of money and you need a company that can build rockets. Turns out Elon Musk has both. So his chances of building that, all these have technical limitations, but after they landed a rocket booster, you know, and after they started testing the Raptor engine, you know, the three big technical hurdles there for me were, one, can you land a rocket back? They did that. Second one, can you build, you know, a large scale methane powered engine? Done that. The next step is, can you build your big cryo tanks, your composite composite tanks, which stopped the development in the 1990s of trying to build the national space plane because we couldn't build composite materials that were that strong back then. Now we can. So those big three technical hurdles for me are like, well, it's a matter of finance. So. Boring company, Hyperloop, it's a matter of like, I mean, there's a working Hyperloop on SpaceX property. It's a mile long, you know, and it's, you know, for ants. They built it. But trying to build one a large scale is not up to just their prowess or the prowess of the companies involved. It's a lot of people. Got to say yes.
So. Yeah, I think that's ultimately the problem is that and here's the problem. Is that it's easier to get to Mars than it is to get from DC to New York in under 30 minutes, right?
I watched.
That this will happen.
Mike Pence had Vice President Pence had the meeting of the National Space Council a couple weeks ago, and he had the heads from different agencies there, including the Office of Budget Management, transportation, et cetera, all that. And they had Blue Origin, they had SpaceX, and some other companies there, Sierra Nevada. They're talking about what they're trying to do for space. And they're all like, let us know what we can do to streamline, know us what red tape we can cut, let us know what we can do to make this thing happen. Because at that federal level there, they're very eager to increase, you know, they look at space and commerce and all this, and they're super enthusiastic about that. And so when you have an environment where they're like, hey, tell us what you need, here's my number, just call me, we can fix that, that's great. When you're trying to build a long distance tunnel that's got to go through counties, cities, states, and everybody wants their little piece of it, and the environmental hazards, et cetera. It's challenging.
Hey, you teased a certain, was it a Bigfoot story?
So first, speaking of teasing.
Yeah. Hey, how about we tease you with the fact that you can tease your money into our hands by going to the teasing website of patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where we go ahead and get the cash to do this podcast each and every week for you. Head on over there right now. Hey, Bryce, what do you get if you become a patron?
Well, you get early access to our sister show After Things, which is all about being a creative professional, and you get that in its own RSS feed. So if you like listening to this podcast, you can get After Things early, right where you're already listening to the show.
Yeah, man, and not for nothing, but there are some that will tell you right to your face that After Things is the real gem of the stuff that we do every Monday.
So I want to do, before we go into the Bigfoot story, I want to talk about another really exciting thing that happened in space, and that's Blue Origin. They successfully test-fired their BE-4 engine. Okay, the BE-4 is a massively powerful engine. I'm trying to find the specs on it, but it's probably one of the most powerful engines since probably some of the Saturn, you know, what powered the Saturn V's, okay? It is very, very exciting because it's methane. It uses methane, which means it's highly reusable. It's designed for reusability. This is what Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, wants to power their new Glenn rocket. It's also ULA is talking to them about using it to power their next generation rocket, the Vulcan rocket. This thing is a beast. It's an absolute beast. And in the race for space, it's in a huge development because what Blue Origin says, hey, yeah, we're going to make this available to other companies because right now we have a problem. Most of our rocket engines kind of come from Russia. And I don't know if you've heard the news on that. It's, you know, it depends, you know, what where, you know, the political climate is. But sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes it's a bad thing. At the moment, it's a bad thing. And they want to use it for, again, the new Glenn, possibly for the Vulcan. And also, Boeing is designing the DARPA XS-1, a reusable space plane. And there's talk about the idea that this could be could have been a possibility for there. But actually, I think the contract went to Aerojet Rocketdyne. But this has applications for other people. So other people will be able to buy this.
So this, and forgive me for making it all about the race to space 3.0, but is this going to be enough that their new Glenn rocket will be able to go to orbit, or are they still in suborbital land?
This is for orbit. So this is going to go for orbital, and so New Glenn will be orbital. So that's the plan. This is a much more powerful rocket. Totally, this is an orbital class engine.
But it's still one stage to orbit.
No, New Glenn is going to be two stage, and the second stage will have a single BE-4, and it'll be what's called like a vacuum formation, which means a longer nozzle because you've got to have because it's in a vacuum essentially, and so for your combustion and your power to work, you have to do that. Now, there is so far the New Glenn, the upper stage is not going to be reusable, and that's the one of things. The New Glenn will have two stages to it, upper, lower. Lower, they're looking to do full reusability like SpaceX. Upper stage does not look at this point like it'll be reusable, and there's a challenge because if it's powered by this engine and it's got the vacuum, the bell, the larger nozzle for that, it'll be tricky to try to figure out how to reuse that unless they come up with some other radical thing. I'm not in the position anymore of saying, you can't do this. And then somebody figures out a way to do it.
That's great, though. One of the things that we've been really, I think, fairly consistent on is that more competitors is nothing but great news in the space race.
Absolutely, and that's why I wanted to make a point. This is great. This is a super powerful engine. This is an exciting, exciting, exciting thing. And it's just, you know, stepping stone, but it's technically speaking, we haven't had engines like this between the Merlin and now the Raptor engines and now the BE-4 engines and the BE-3, which came before. These are the most modern engines that we haven't really created engines in 40 years here since the shuttle engines. The SLS rocket, the SLS program, which, by the way, side note, the SLS is going to use literally leftover shuttle engines. Literally, we found some shuttle engines in a warehouse, and we're going to use that for this. Okay.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's where that is. And they had
vintage.
Congress asked NASA to say, hey, what are the estimated costs for the next mission after you want to do the manned test of the SLS? And NASA's like, we don't have an estimate. It's like, we weren't mandated to come up with one, so we don't have one. Can't tell you. It'd be ongoing costs.
That sounds a little rough.
Tell you what, if they don't list the price, it's going to be pretty expensive. That's a lesson I've learned in life.
And what's going to happen is that we're going to, the SLS program, they're going to try to, you know, test this and launch crew eventually at a point and do the first, like, a, you know, maybe do a deep space mission with the craft on there. But the challenge is going to be around the time they're going to maybe say, hey, we want a lot more funding for this thing, or the contractors want that. I was thinking about big milestones, like next, maybe December, maybe January, Falcon Heavy launch, hopefully. Okay. Summertime, summer, scheduled for summer, Crew Dragon, actual crew, actual NASA astronauts on a Dragon spacecraft, on a Falcon 9 rocket in a Dragon spacecraft. A couple months later, maybe Boeing's going to launch one of theirs with, it'll be on top of, I think, like an Atlas or a Delta. I forget which one's the human-rated one. Okay, so you're going to get that. And then if SpaceX is moving along with the development of the BFR, watching the BFR test stand, watching the test rockets at that point, you know, imagine the point at which we see this thing launch. Imagine when they have these things, a couple of these things, watching these things do that butt-to-butt thing to refuel. It's... And then New Glenn, you know, New Glenn is sort of kind of looked upon like, well, it's, they're way behind SpaceX. Yeah, but they're way ahead of everybody else.
All right. Can you stop hiding from the truth and give us the truth about this Sasquatch story?
Yeah.
Listen, guys, I don't know what your personal connection is to Bigfoot, but I'm a little bit worried. I'm a little bit worried for my friend Justin here. The legendary Bigfoot and others like it have reportedly been spotted near a Northern California lake, which sounds like I think we need to have an investigative trip by Justin and Ashley.
Jeffrey Gonzalez,
a self-described paranormal expert, said he heard from a local farmer who saw the creature and four or five others running on his ranch near Avocado Lake. One of them, which was extremely tall, had a pig over its shoulder, he said, and the five scattered, and the one of the pig was running so fast it didn't see an integration pipe and it tripped, with the pig flying over. No. According to his Facebook page, Gonzalez talk show host and investigator at Paranormal Central, in addition to being a technician at AT&T. So he also founded the Sanger Paranormal Society. So we've got since sightings aren't that uncommon, sightings the past 5 years, East Fresno County.
All right, hold on. I have felt like I don't know that I've ever seen it flatly stated, but I assume part of all the good PR for Sasquatch is that he's not a predator eating our livestock.
Well, Brian, times are tough.
Hey, I mean, by the way, I've done some preliminary research here on Avocado Lake. Almost exactly equidistant driving directions between Burbank and Oakland. Both
I'm in.
Hours, 20 minutes.
I'm in. If you're saying a meetup, I'm in.
I'm saying it's almost exactly the same.
So what's your point? Your point is we should both go there and meet up.
Yeah.
100%.
By the way, that's close to where a friend of the show, Brett Rounceville, was raised.
Can we get back to the ethical and marketing implications of what happens once it becomes clear that Sasquatch is a predator? If there's a bigger than man sized beast with man clever hands and murder of in his heart, that changes the picture of Bigfoot. Like, it's never occurred to me that we need a Bigfoot defense perimeter until now.
Well, I'm saying you're a little bit biased here. So what do you think Bigfoot was surviving on in the forest?
Same thing. Gorillas.
Sorry, Brian, your privilege is showing. We can't just go hunting down Bigfoot because you heard a rumor.
I had assumed that much like gorillas that largely survive on fruits and nuts in the occasional omnivorous situation, I figured that was the situation with Bigfoot. But if he's running around with a pig over his shoulder, the dude's a menace. He's a menace.
You know, it's weird because here you disparage Bigfoot so much. Yeah, I'm looking at your beard, and you're kind of like trying to co-op Bigfoot culture a bit.
I may identify a little bit Bigfooty. I'm not gonna lie. It's
So apparently,
we have now done a hard zoom into the thicket that is Brian Brushwood's beard. By the way, everybody follow at Schwood for the public dialogue that Brian is currently having. Is
hashtag join the conversation.
Like any kind of public works project, he is now soliciting public comment on the future of the beard.
Belongs to all of us, especially to Bigfoot. I don't want Bigfoot. I don't like the idea of Bigfoot eating meat. I don't like it. I'm against it.
Wow. What do you eat, Brian? Yeah, how's that vegan diet work?
It's not wrong for me to want something better than I am for Bigfoot.
Better. Okay. I mean, so
superior.
He's morally less than you if he eats meat?
No, he's unfortunately morally equal to, and I want him to be
equal.
Better
so
than
equal. Oh, okay.
I want him to be enlightened. I want him to be thoughtful and kind and patient and write thank you notes and send them in the actual mail. Not an email,
things.
Not a text, not a thumbs up on your Facebook
two things,
page.
Brian. One, so now you're saying Bigfoot isn't as enlightened as you because you know better than what Bigfoot does.
For shame.
Two, I'm going to throw this out there.
Yeah.
Was this pig a farm pig? It looked like it was a pig. It's not a hog. It was a pig. Was Bigfoot maybe rescuing him from the dinner table?
Aquarian
lifestyle.
Well, now we get into the awkward question of whether he's stealing property or liberating a life.
Would you save a pig to feed your family, Brian?
I mean, you're not wrong. I'm just saying.
Is he liberating the pig? Is Bigfoot an animal rights activist who is taking direct action?
That seems fairly unlikely, right?
Whoa, the patriarchy, the hominidarchy here is really, really kind of, you know, annoying. You know,
I rescind my protest and I check
watch
my privilege.
Watch as Brian Humansplains this.
I don't know. Yeah. I leave it. Hit us up on Twitter. Tell us if you're okay with the idea of him being a...
Or the show email. We have an email for the show. You can email.
Yeah.
Neshcom@gmail.com. Put weird things in the subject line.
Yeah.
So, listen, gentlemen. Oh. What time is it?
Oh. Oh, wait. Might it indeed be time for Journey Quest?
Previously on...
Journey Quest!
Have you ever wondered what exists beyond the borders of this town?
But the foolish Brian that came to town and rejected what was obviously God's path for him.
And there is a letter, last will and testament, of Brian the First.
So I think I decided to help defend the town, right?
Yeah, I totally forgot we're at that point. You totally decided to help protect the town. So Brian came across this Wild West town run by, what was it, a 9-year-old mayor?
9-year-old mayor, yep.
And you have agreed to protect the town from the marauders.
Yeah.
May or may not show up. I mean, it definitely seems like you got conscripted by a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think your first step right now, Brian, is you want to maybe start to protect the town. Like, it's kind of wide open. Looks like something out of a Hollywood backlot. Maybe.
Yeah.
You wanna...
What are my resources? Is my army of monkeys still on my side, or are they totally driven?
Yeah,
to
they're getting kind of friendly with the locals, though. I'm just saying, though. You know, they love that swing set. They've been hanging around the kindergarten.
Okay. All right. So I clap my one good hand to my chest. Like, hey.
Oh, wait, they're working the pump to do the slip and slide.
All right. I say, hey, gather around. Meeting. And then I rev my chainsaw hand. Get on over here.
And now they all scatter because they're afraid of they watch you decapitate
okay,
their friend.
Okay, all right. Wait, I apologize loudly. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to start it. I know you're – come on. I hope I'm not making fun of them. But I asked for some bananas to attract all of my monkeys.
We're apes, Brian. Apes. They signed you. We're apes, Brian, not monkeys.
Okay, that's fine. I say, great. I say, listen up. Ape, you're apes. I'm apes. We're all apes. Guess what? We're about to be under attack. Focus. Look at me. All the bananas are about to be taken away. All of your go-karts are about to be taken away. The only way, we got to dig tunnels and trenches. We got it. We got to dig trenches and get ready for an attack. A bunch of you guys dig holes and lay down things over you so that you can pop up and surprise the enemy when they come in. A bunch of you guys dig a big old trench filled with gasoline and fire ants. And a couple of you start writing a song about the epic last stand we're about to have.
Well, Brian, the most intelligent apes, signs to you, what do you think we are, the Army Corps of Engineers, were chimpanzees.
I grin and close my eyes and nod approvingly of like, I believe in you. Dig a trench, bro.
And they start flinging poo.
Okay. I go to the 9-year-old mayor and I say, hey, you don't happen to have an Army Corps of Engineers or anyone who can do anything to help fortify? You're not giving me much to work with here, sir.
Yeah, you have the town people. He tells you we have the town people.
All right. I turn to the town people. I say, all of you take a monkey to use as manual labor.
They're apes, sir. These are apes. Monkeys, generally speaking, have tails. There's a clear delineation, too.
I'm just
if you look at both the hands and the feet, you'll notice, and there are some different teeth structures.
I swear to God. I say, you know what? I'm going to take a moment to commune with my gods. And I walk outside of the town, and by the
You're
way, we're
followed by all of your chimpanzees, by the way.
All right. I turn around and I give them a shooing motion and I say, give me a moment.
They
to
all
figure
start
this
shooing
out.
Each other because it's fun to do.
All right. So I try to figure out if there's any way for me to get word to Justin, because clearly I am not capable of handling
this. This is already my favorite silent film of all time.
Do I have any inkling where Justin is? I know we both landed in the same jungle.
Is that a windstorm blowing through town? Is there some dust?
I look to the dust and I try to ascertain if it's an entire mob of enemies approaching.
You hear cling, 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 cling. A Lee Van Cleef kind of, walking through a town.
I walk up to Chimpanzee 278. I say, 278, check it out. Find out what's in that dust cloud.
278 runs into the dust cloud and doesn't come back.
I look to 279 and I gesture kind of a half shrug. But also I'm doing this scales balancing move to indicate like, hey, you understand the difficult situation I'm in. I can't just not know what's in that cloud. And then I raise my eyebrows expectantly at 279, hoping he gets the gist without me having to insist it out loud.
Yeah, man, we all remember that great scene in Patton when strong leadership was needed and he just lifted both hands as if to say, I don't know. And then there's, there's a lot of merit on the both sides of this argument. Why don't you make a call?
I'm glad you picked up what I'm putting down. I sort of gesture, jerking my head to the left like, huh?
So 279 does this.
He looks at me.
Raises an eyebrow.
He gives you the big rock eyebrow for all of our audio listeners.
I pull out two bananas. I hand one in front of him. But then when he reaches for it, I kind of jerk it back, look at him expectantly to see if he's going to nod and understands that he only gets the other banana if he goes in.
And he tries to bite off your hand, but it's the chainsaw hand and his teeth hurt and he whimpers.
Yeah. And then I say, see, you brought this on yourself. Go look inside there. Come back. Right. Two bananas for you.
He goes into the dust cloud. He's gone.
Cling,
cling, cling. It's getting closer, Brian. Cling,
I say, everybody cling. Hide. Get up in the attics. Everybody hide.
Everybody starts to run and hide. The chimpanzees are still on the slip and slide.
I say, last warning, 172, 458. I swear, don't you test me. You hide or you're going to get eaten by the dust cloud.
And somehow, without even verbal skills, it's able to out-bargain you like I've listened to your children do.
too good, too right.
Oh, 5 minutes.
Yeah. I'm like, go.
You're like, all right, just go put the slip and slide inside of the saloon. That's okay. All right.
We drag the slip and slide in. I'm just hide. And then I take refuge up in like a church steeple or something.
All right.
Peek out.
Cloud of dust moves through town. Cling, 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 cling. It's the middle of the street. Right below the church steeple.
I look for a crucifix and I throw it out in at where the sound is coming from, just in case it's a vampire.
And you hear "ow" in Justin's voice, and the cloud starts to fade away. And there, Justin, dressed in Wild West gear, appears to be standing right before you, holding the hands of two chimpanzees.
I see, Justin, you're not no Dracula, are you?
Oh my God. Brian, what the hell? Did you throw this crucifix at me?
I hold up my one good pinky. And I say, pinky swear, you're not a Dracula. You're not no Draculas.
Yes, Brian, I'm not a Dracula. And I give you the pinky swear salute.
All right.
Now, you quickly reconnect, and Justin explains about after he left some crazy shopping mall filled with homicidal children, he ran into a jungle. Last thing he remembers was a blow dart hitting him in the neck, waking up in this cabin at the edge of the jungle where he found the Wild West gear and decided that he was going to trek and try to find his buddy Brian.
Hey, listen up, Justin. I know it's messed up, but I've got what appears to be, for the moment, an army of chimpanzees and a town that's about to be under attack. They weren't entirely
clear. One of the
clear.
Chimpanzees is already on Justin's back with, like, his best buddies. The other ones are rolling around at his feet. You know, they can't get enough of him. Just
I take a moment to explain. You got to remember, chimpanzees are fickle. They're fickle, and they go to whatever's shiny and new. It's not an
Justin
indication
nods,
of quality.
And the chimpanzees run over, grab chairs, and sit down quietly.
I say, listen, they're doing this now, but they're going to turn on you. They don't know what
another one runs up to him, hands him a sandwich.
I'm eating the sandwich as I delicately dab the corners of my mouth to make sure that nothing gets on my vintage Wild West gear. What's the deal? Why are you even here? What do you mean people are attacking? Like we're supposed
oh, that's
to be
the sound
on
of
the move.
Cold beer being handed to you by a chimpanzee. Sorry.
I say, look, listen up. You've watched The Magnificent Seven. You've seen Three Amigos. You've read Wolves of the Cala by Stephen King, the most underrated of the entire Dark Tower series. This is a town that needs some outsiders to protect them.
All right. Well, here, hold on. Maybe something can be worked out. Who brought you in on this whole thing?
I call out, Mr. Mayor.
The mayor comes out and, hey, what are you guys? What's going, who's this, Brian?
this is my partner in crime, so to speak, not actual crime. I know we're in the lawless west of an alternate dimension, but we're not actually criminals. This is my partner in crime, Justin Robert Young. I don't make a move without him. And I certainly make sure we always agree before doing anything rash or imprudent.
So let me get this straight, Mr. Mayor. Brian came in here, and you told him that there were marauders, and he had to defend the town. Yeah, that's what I said. Justin pulls out a gun and shoots the 9-year-old mayor in the head.
I just freeze aghast.
Problem solved. I don't know why it took you so long to do that. That was way easy.
Ding, ding.
Somebody's ringing the bell in the town, and you hear a voice saying, "Stagecoach is coming! Stagecoach is coming!"
I turn and, beside myself, mentioned, "You literally just shot the messenger."
No. The problem was you couldn't move because the town was under attack. Consider this your indulgence, my lord. We're free to go. We can do whatever we want. We can just leave. We can deal with these people if we want. We can leave if we want. Totally up to the world's our oyster, bro. Come on.
Gesture to the clearly ringing bell warning of an impending attack, And I just sort of...
No, just a stagecoach, Brian. Just a stagecoach. Tack sounds totally different. That would be four ringing bells in a row.
Oh, my eyebrows right, lift this? Up so
number
high.
Number one, I need chimpanzees 150 through 170. Let's go ahead and get that corpse out of here. That's bad for business. We need to just bring on in the stagecoach. We'll give them a good old welcome wagon. I need a 183 to 187. You guys do your little dance routine that welcomes everybody into the town. Hey, Brian, do me a favor. Just give me a real quick dab, a napkin on your... On your chest there, there's some child blood on it.
Unbelieving, I clean off the child blood and lean over to Justin saying, oh, I figured we were just going to move on to the next step. You're saying we just stay here and become the mayors?
Yeah, let's just see what's up with this stagecoach. The stagecoach pulls up and I say, howdy, strangers. Welcome to the town.
I inject myself unnecessarily like, yeah, howdy, hoping to stay relevant in the conversation.
So two men in silken livery are driving the stagecoach, and they just face forward. They don't say anything to you, nothing to you, okay? It's a golden stagecoach. The door opens up. Creak. The silken curtains start to bellow in the wind. A little red carpet starts to roll out, and a man steps forward wearing what we would call kind of almost like medieval level finery, but just covered in jewels, has a big emblem there, his big puffy sort of hat, and he's holding a scroll.
Not sure what the name of the town is. I say, well, welcome to our town, which I assume you came here on purpose for.
This is indeed, sir. I bring you a message.
Ah, okay. From whom?
The Golden Emperor.
The Golden Emperor.
Nice. Awesome.
Yes, he hands you the scroll, says, these are the terms of which you must surrender or be destroyed. Have a good day.
I take a look at the terms.
Nice monkeys. Gets back into the stagecoach.
Hey, wait, hold on. Wait. Golden Emperor messenger. Can you just 2 seconds? I just want to just review this real quick, make sure that we're in compliance.
Hold on. He's rolling down the window. Creak, creak. Creek. Hey, Sam gets caught in here. It takes me a moment.
Creek. Sure. Just do me a favor. Can you just lean in? I come up right to the edge of the stagecoach, and I'm
pulls apart the silken curtain, and you hear there's like a blast of air conditioning coming from there, which is kind of weird. And you hear like the sound of a TV in there too, and a minibar. Yes.
I'm just trying to check in here because I'm kind of confused by this clause on why you would be dumb enough to open your window. Pa! And I shoot him right.
Boom!
In the face.
Blood starts to gurgle out of his neck where he got shot. The men on top.
I turned to
Justin.
Can you
kill those real quick, or else? I mean, I can kill them too if you want. But just if you want to kill them, we can just kill them real quick.
Looking for weapons right now.
I rev up my. I begrudgingly, with an eye rolling, snarky scoff, I start up my chainsaw and slaughter all of the Herald's men.
Well, you actually want to do that, but by the time that you've actually revved up your chainsaw, I've done a cartwheel and I've shot both of them in the head. And I'm like, hey, man, don't worry. It's totally fine. I can do it quicker. It's totally cool. 3 down. Hey, great news. Free golden stagecoach. What? This is the best day ever. We got a town. We got a stagecoach. World's our oyster, baby.
I explain that we're going to have a serious talking to after we go mudding in this sweet, sweet stagecoach. Let's get this out of our system real fast. I whip the horses and I say, to that mud over there. And I kick them into first gear and spin them around, kicking up lots of mud.
This is the best day ever, right?
Horses start heading out of town back towards the way they came from.
I say, knock it off. Turn around. Go back to our place.
They go faster.
All right. Oh,
this is great. They're probably bringing us back to the Golden Emperor.
You know what? Why not? Let's go meet this Golden Emperor face to face. And when we show up, real quick, are there any corpses that we could steal all their clothes to disguise ourselves as?
You forgot to take the bodies off of the stagecoach.
Okay. Well, in that case, I get in the back. I open up the minibar. I start watching TV. And I decide it's up to new mayor, Justin.
No, we're not really mayors. We just, I mean, you seem to have a problem with that 9-year-old kid bossing you around and telling you what to do and everything.
You straight up murdered the leader of the town and assumed leadership of the town.
No, I didn't assume leadership. I welcomed in a stagecoach, which we're in, by the way. You're welcome.
I look and try to figure out what's the hardest alcohol they have in this mini bar.
Next time on Journey Quest.
Man.
Where is the stagecoach heading?
To the Golden Emperor, I hope.
Maybe. Gentlemen, do you have any picks?
I sure do. Hot damn. I did not expect to feel so passionate about this. But while I was out of town at Disney, I don't know if I've told you this, Andrew. I enjoyed the ever-loving hell out of The Naturalist. I think it's your best work. I think it's your most approachable, your most human work. Not that you're not human, but I think that
right. That'd be weird.
I think that I adore the characters. And it's great. The Naturalist is wonderful. And to put in perspective how much I enjoyed it, as I got to the end, I joked to the kids that it's a real roller coaster of an ending. I might just listen to it while I'm on Space Mountain. And then the kids laughed, and then they laughed, and then we got on to the ride of Space Mountain, and I realized I would rather listen to the rest of The Naturalist than whatever the sound effects were on Space Mountain. So I listened to the roller coaster ending of The Naturalist while on an actual roller coaster, much to my children's chagrin.
That's amazing. Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. It's a lot of fun writing that book, and the next one comes out in March. Looking Glass, and working on making sure that I can keep Theo Cray's stories coming. That's all I have to say about that.
it was great, and it took zero time to get its hooks into me. Like, I would say I listened to the first like 5 to 15 minutes, and I realized, oh yeah, this is what I'm doing with every free minute for the next week. It was great.
Cool. Thank you, man. That means a lot to me. I'm glad you like it. It'd be really awkward if you didn't. Justin?
So on my flight down to Southern California, tickets for Thor Ragnarok. And I, after all the really great reviews for that, I decided to watch Doctor Strange. And you want to know what? It's one of those, I really appreciated a lot of the nuances in that story, including, you know, how well they set up. I love that initial, initial like 15 minute the opening action sequence, because in a lot of modern science fiction, you know, I don't think there's a lot of time and effort put into explaining kind of the rules. And I really just kind of appreciated that in this opening sequence, you just get a lot of like, okay, this is what magic looks like. This is what creating this kind of like magical barrier looks like. This is, you know, somebody has to like stop and do a thing to make a portal happen. And that's going to factor into some of the action set pieces later. And so much science fiction and can kind of just be fantasy. And not to say this isn't science fantasy, but like it so much matters to establish some kind of rule set that you're going to stick by. And you know, Doctor Strange doesn't necessarily, the point of Doctor Strange isn't that necessarily, but I love that they took the time to do it, and I really appreciated it, and I appreciated it again when I watched it 2 days ago.
Yeah, it really, really holds up, and part of that is just because of the utterly eye-pleasing visuals are so, so good, but also the consistency of the universe, and also the characters.
Yeah.
It was such a delight, because that was a movie that I was expecting I wanted it to be good, but I was fearful it was not. And it just way exceeded my expectations. And I would say, and I offer that as proof of like, it's a movie that I walked into prepared to not like it, prepared to be like, they didn't do this right or didn't do this wrong, you know, everything like this. And it delighted me, like Wonder Woman. These movies were ones that just, not that I had low expectations. I just heard stories and stuff that I'm like, oh, I'll see this. I'm like, no, this is great. And I'm glad I was so wrong. And it just the way they used magic, the way the visuals served the story and not just, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? You know, that was wonderful. Yeah. My pick is, I've talked about this before, the show Red Dwarf,
which was a British show started back in like 1988. If you're a fan of like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's a really fun, quirky kind of show about this man named Lister, who is the last human alive because he was on a spacecraft and he got in trouble for bringing a cat on board, this big, huge mining ship, the Red Dwarf, and he got put in the stasis booth. Meanwhile, his coworker, Rimmer, forgot to seal down a drive plate. There was a radiation leak and killed everybody on board the spacecraft. So the AI in charge of it put it on a path out of the solar system and waited until the ship was decontaminated to let Lister back out of the stasis booth, which just happened to be 3 million years later. So humanity's gone. His only companions are his former coworker, who's been brought back as a hologram. And then the cat that he brought on board had kitties, and it had kitties, and they had kitties, and they evolved into like humanoid cat people. And the last one of them is a guy called Cat, who likes to dress very fashionably. And it's basically a very compact sort of story in the characters. Sometimes they have the AI on the ship called Holly. Sometimes it's a guy, sometimes it's a girl. And a later season, they got Crichton, which was their mechanical manservant. And it's a fun show if you're into that kind of thing. Started in 1988, and then it went off the air after a few years. Then it came back, and then it went away. And then it came back again on the British network Dave. And so here we are. Started in 1988. Now we're at season 12, and they've got some new episodes up. They've had two episodes so far this season, and I think they're great. I went back and I watched the entire series all the way through again, and I love where the series is right now. And you get lines like, you know, is it because I'm Hitler?
Yeah.
Meaning, you know, that you know, perhaps we see Hitler brought back and somebody doesn't want to be friends with Hitler. And he's like, is it because I am Hitler? You know? And it's just when you see that, it's a very, very funny. A lot of great stuff in there. So I was very, very thrilled. So that if you have the BritBox, which is a subscription available on like Amazon Prime and other services, you get access to all the Red Dwarf episodes, a ton of British content, whatever. So check it out.
Awesome.
They tried to make an American version of Red Dwarf, and it didn't quite work, but they tried. Anyhow, it's my pick.
Yeah.
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.